Live from the NBC News Radio broadcasting studios of KCAA, 1050 AM, 102.3 FM, and 106.5 FM, located in beautiful sunny California. Thanks for tuning in to the Water Zone. So, guess what? It's time to get aboard the Water Zone. I'm Rob Starr, along with my Chris Davies. We're having a crazy day today.
It's been nuts for sure. Busy, and a shakeup earlier in the week. I mean, literally, yes. A shakeup early in the week.
Yeah, 4.4.
Yep, in Laverne, California, right next to where I live.
Oh, I don't hear anything in the headphones. Do you?
Nope, I don't.
I don't know if we lost something or other, but I hope everybody can hear me. I hope we're broadcasting. Okay, we just got nothing in the headphones, so I'll let our engineer work on that. Anyway, I hope everybody had a great week. It is a nice temperature out here in the high 90s, and I guess it's getting hotter on tomorrow through Sunday.
Well, that's good for the weekend. You know, the kids like to swim and get in the pool and go to the beach and all that stuff. So last hurrah, but we're used to in Southern California here to heat waves in September, so sure we've got something coming.
I hope so. It should be nice. Ah, we got sound now.
Got the home.
Whatever
got the
you did good. We want to thank our engineer. Give him a hand.
All right, Nick, ready to go, bud.
All right, good boy. We like him. He's one of the best ones we've ever had.
Wipe that sweat off your brow.
Yeah, he's shaking in the booth. If anybody, too bad we can't point the camera on him. Get a view of him. He's a pretty good guy. We like him a lot. I think we'll keep him. We have clout. Anyway, we have a great show today. As always, we're going to have one of our most favorite people on, and I think she's on the line because I see it blinking. And I'd like to introduce Miss Chris Austin, the purveyor of Maven's Notebook. Good afternoon, Chris. How are you doing today?
Hey, I'm doing great. We're not frying out here in Santa Clarita, so hey, we're good.
Oh, that's good.
It's nice weather.
Yeah. Well, last night it was pretty good. It had a little breeze coming through, and it was, sat outside, had dinner. It was really nice, and appreciate that for a change. And
we had dinner outside as well last night.
Did you?
It was marvelous.
Copycat?
Yeah. I was going to say you were copying us.
Yeah, I guess. Well, good people, right? You know what they say. I can't say it on the air, but what the heck? I hear crackling, too, so yeah. He's checking that out now. If you hear a bzzz, that means he's electrocuted himself and he won't be back for the rest of the show. But he's doing a good job. Anyway, so Chris, tell us what's going on in the world of water in California.
Oh, my word. Well, let's see.
It's a busy week.
You know, the big brouhaha, I guess, in the last 24 hours was, the State Water Project was built back in the 1960s. I think, and at the time, all the water districts signed contracts with the Department of Water Resources. The majority of those were Southern California water districts, and those contracts had a 50-year life term, I think, thereabouts. So they kind of terminate around 2035. So if you've done any municipal financing or financing really of any really large numbers, you really want 30 years, to be able to buy these bonds for. But you were at 2018 and these bonds expired in the contracts expire in 2035. So they're unable at this time to issue bonds for maintenance that might be needed on the State Water Project. Back 5 years ago, they had a pumping plant catch fire and burn, so they needed to replace that pumping plant. And generally, you want to do this by purchasing bonds, but the bonds can't go past the termination date of the contracts of the people who are paying the bills. So they have renegotiated the contracts. They have some agreements and principles, and they're about ready to extend these. I believe it's out to 2070 or something. It's to extend these contracts for just regular maintenance that might be needed, but it is also, the contractors are on the hook. So they'd be on the hook for the Delta Tunnels or the Cal Water fix as well. Although the amendment itself is not specifically about the Delta Tunnels, but if they're extending their agreement to pay out to 2070 in an adjunct sort of way it is. Hmm. So,
can't they buy insurance?
Huh?
Can't they buy insurance?
It's bonds, you know, bonds. So it, and they issue bonds against the revenues that they receive, and it's the water district to pay the revenues. So, you know, in order to issue the bonds, they needed the contract dates extended.
Okay.
So, in order to extend the contracts, there must be a legislative hearing. And so they scheduled that legislative hearing a few weeks ago, but the Delta Tunnel opponents were quite effective in getting that hearing postponed. So the legislature tried to schedule that for this morning at 8 a.m., but they actually scheduled it like on yesterday. I don't think it actually even got posted on the website till late in the afternoon. So that had a lot of people calling, or the Delta Tunnel opponents calling foul, and they're very good at whipping up their base, and they managed to get the hearing postponed yet again. So it did not happen this morning. Now, the significance of this is that on Friday, tomorrow, the legislature is the final recess, meaning we have like a two-year legislative cycle. So, you know, this was the final recess of the legislature as it exists. In November, we have new elections, and in January, everyone who was reelected is now back in the, you know, back in the legislature, with the exception of the Senate, which have four-year terms, but, you know, the assemblymen have two-year terms. So here we go. So and the water code states that the contract must be, you know, must have this hearing in front of the legislature 60 days before they approve the contract. So if the legislature adjourns for final recess on Friday, and they haven't had this hearing on the State Water Project contract extensions, I'm not quite sure how they could have it before the legislature readjourns or comes back in its new, you know, form in January, which is a big problem for, you know, moving forward and getting financing on something like the tunnel. So it's been an amazing turn of events. You know, no one should discount the power of Restore the Delta and their ability to mobilize their base. They're actually quite effective. They've now postponed this hearing twice.
Right. So outside of the political arena, who else is pushing? Is it like newspapers or just public or NGOs, or, you know, is it all one group?
Well, you know, in terms of tunnel opponents, Restore the Delta is the largest of the tunnel opponents, but, you know, there's not a lot of love in the environmental community for the Delta Tunnel.
Excuse me for laughing.
That's the way to put it, you know.
Right.
I think there are a number of people, individuals in this arena that, as individuals, sort of speaking off the record, there are some that will say, you know, it probably would help the fish, but there's also an equal, if not larger, number that say that it won't. The truth is, we don't really know. Reverse flows are an issue. A lot of things are an issue, but until you actually do stuff, you're not really sure how the system's going to respond.
Yeah, sure.
You know, but one thing we do know is that, you know, the reliability of water coming through the Delta really does depend on the health of the ecosystem and, you know, how we get that water there. So, meaning conveyance, meaning the tunnel. So it's going to be interesting to see how it all plays out in the long run. But they're trying to get as much approved on these tunnels before Brown leaves office. And no one knows exactly what's going to happen when the new governor comes in. But the flip side is that I'm not sure the new governor can interfere with this process because it's not a government project. It's you know, a project that if the water agencies have it permitted, I don't see that there's an intervening point for the governor or the legislature, really, at this point.
Even if it involves California land? Owned land?
Well, you know, again, I'm not really a legal expert.
No, me either. I'm just throwing things out.
You know, but I do think that, you know, if this project is far enough down the road, I'm not really seeing how the governor or legislature can step in. And I would have thought that if there was a way to have a ballot initiative, that the tunnel opponents would have put it on the ballot by now.
Well, one would have thought that.
Yeah, I mean, and I can't imagine that they haven't thought that themselves. So there must be, you know, a reason why they haven't, you know, legal reason why. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see how this all plays out.
Yep. Well, speaking, you know, about the new governor coming in, whomever that may be, you know, remember last week we were talking about an idea we had about getting Newsom and John Cox on the show. And having a debate. I already talked to the American Water Works Association, California and Nevada section, Tim Worley, who's the executive director. And I also talked to Tim Quinn, who's the executive director of the Association of California Water Agencies. And they all think that's a great idea, that we'd gather about a dozen questions from prominent water agencies throughout California affected by, you know, like Central California, Northern California, the coast, you know, metropolitan water and so forth, and have them come up with pertinent questions that affect their regions, and then we would pass them to both Cox and Newsom, and then when they come on the show, so they'll have the questions ahead of time, and they'll come on the show, and we'll ask them the questions, and we'll see what their positions are. I did make contact with John Cox's campaign manager. He works for the Wayne Johnson agency up in Sacramento, and then I'm waiting to see what we do with Newsom. But any of our listeners, if they hear, they should give those two a call. And tell them they need to come on the show and tell us what their feelings are about these water issues. We need to know.
Every governor is likely, as I think in the past, has come up with some major water issue to deal with.
Right.
Drought or, you know, wildfires or floods or, you know, you name it. Tunnels.
I think this would be a good thing for our listeners to hear that. And like I said, AWWA and the AC, Association of California Water, AQUA, they really want this thing to happen. And also talking to the League of Women Voters. So I guess all I can do is ask our listeners to call those two people and, you know, both Cox's campaign and Newsom's campaign and say, hey, you guys need to come together and do this by phone. They don't have to come here to the studio. They can stay wherever they are. You know, that we don't have to see them, but we do want to hear them. I got a lot of questions I'd like to ask, but I'm going to leave this to the water agencies to pose their questions. Anyway, that's what we talked about last week, so I'm excited about that. At least it's hopefully moving forward.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
Yep.
All right. Hey, Kiss, so I know that there's a couple of environmental issues that came to the forefront this week, and you know, Chris, I'm always drawn to the science news section of Maven's Notebook. I mean, not that I don't like the Daily Digest and news worth noting, but man, I go right to the science section, right? So come up, the images that came from NASA. I don't know, Chris, if you got a chance to look at them very much, but I spent a little bit of time today.
They're cool.
Yeah, they were really cool pictures, right? So it shows the effect of the wildfires on the atmosphere. So
well, you know, we see this kind of thing, you know, when we have these really beautiful orange sunsets. What we're really seeing is pollution, and it's really kind of funny, but yeah, pollution can be pretty, huh?
Yeah. Well, the orange sunset can also be the fire flames going too. So,
well, yeah, but you know, you get that stuff in the air. Oh. I used to follow a blogger, a photo blogger. He lived up in Alaska, and he would take these fantastic pictures of Alaska, such a beautiful place. And then he'd come down here, and he would take pictures down here, and he would just be astonished at the pollution. Kind of like, yeah, well, that's, you know, we're used to that. And he's just like, we don't have orange sunsets up in Alaska.
No, but those lights that they have at
Aurora Borealis.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I saw some photos at the Orange County Fair in their exhibit hall. Unbelievably beautiful pictures. Just gorgeous.
Yep. I've seen it myself in person on a trip to northern Canada several years ago, and just jaw-dropping awesome to see it and how fast it is. So, you know, on the smoke...
Yeah, those wildfires, though, the smoke from that has really traveled far.
Yeah, two-thirds of the way across the nation.
Yeah, and up in British Columbia and Canada and stuff, they're just getting, you know, choked from it, you know, as are the people up there.
Right.
Yeah, stunning.
Awesome NASA pictures, right, that came out. And I know by looking at them, some of them are color enhanced so that, you know, it brings out the smoke so you can see it a little better. But folks in Arkansas, Tennessee, you know, the southeast as they've been drifting down and now expected to take some of that remnants of the smoke even up the eastern seaboard. Going north, of course, it's considerably thinned out by then, but just to see how far that's traveled. And then when you read further into the article and find out how many metric tons of pollution, as you were mentioning, Chris, sets in the atmosphere, and what that does to weather conditions across the country, it provides it's like cloud seeding almost, right? Sure. It provides...
Do you think they're ever going to ban barbecuing?
Barbecuing doesn't help.
Certainly hope not. I'm first in line for a porterhouse. So.
No pun intended, but a barbecue doesn't hold a candle to a wildfire in terms of pollution.
No, but also look what the fires do to the water systems as well.
Yeah.
Oh, I know. It's incredible. And what it does to the watershed. Yep. Although we should make a distinction. This is what catastrophic wildfire does. I mean, prescribed burns and low-grade fire is actually a good thing for the forest, not the ones that burn all the trees, but the ones that kind of burn the underbrush.
Yep.
So catastrophic wildfire is bad.
The underbrush.
Prescribed wildfires used properly is good.
Right.
And we have to change people's perception. Not all fire is bad.
No. Right. A naturally occurring event over millenniums. So, you know, it's not like a new thing. It's just that now we got people living here who paid lots of money for their property and houses, and that makes everybody excited.
Well, yeah, and, you know, protection of people and property is foremost. And that's actually, you know, how we kind of got into this situation. I was back in the, I believe, the late 1800s or the early 1900s. They had some dreadful wildfires that went through and hundreds of people died. And so they said, society said, no, we can't have this. This is terrible, which is an understandable response. So they then started jumping on fire suppression. You know, fire suppression is the thing. But we have forests that are adapted to fire. They're meant to have low-grade fire, not catastrophic fire that burns the top of the trees, but the kind of fire that just burns out the underbrush. The Native Americans were really good at this. They knew about this.
Well, imagine what it's like in Africa, in the Serengeti, where every year the fire goes.
Yeah. For months on end. Yeah. Months on end. Yep.
Yeah.
All right. So carrying on the environmental theme for just a minute, right? The other science news that was in Maven's notebook this week was just a very intrinsic look at what's happening with groundwater depletion and the drought, and an alarming headline on the website, Chris, saying that it's actually lowering the elevation of the land in several parts of the Central Valley at what was called in the article an alarming rate. What's going on there?
Sinkholes.
Well, I mean, we've known about this. It's called land subsidence, and it's been going on for years. And at the height of the drought, it's in part why they were able to pass the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, because people started to realize we were really draining these things dry. And you know, land subsidence in the Central Valley due to groundwater pumping is also, it doesn't just affect farmland, it affects canals, irrigation canals, Highway 5, you know, other roads, pipelines. It can be really problematic. And what they found is that it's still continuing today, and that 2017, when we had a really, really wet year, it sort of stemmed it a touch, but it hasn't really slowed down. We still continue to overpump, and as we pump, the land collapses underneath. I mean, it's the same phenomena that's been happening out in Oklahoma and on the Great Plains when they pump the oil out,
yeah,
and
fracking.
The oil's no longer there. Guess what? The land settles.
Yep.
You know, So like the Frying Kern Canal, a major irrigation canal that goes down the east side of the Central Valley, is impacted from land subsidence. It can't carry nearly the amount that it used to carry. So it's a bit of a problem.
Mm. So when this new governor comes in, whoever it may be, what do you think is his number one challenge?
Oh, gosh. You know, there's so much
pick
going
one on
right now.
No, I know, but I figured you're the maven, you know.
Well, what's his biggest water challenge?
Yeah.
I would have to say the biggest water challenge right now is not the tunnels. It is what's going on at the State Water Board.
Yeah.
And the State Water Board is redoing these flow objectives for rivers on the San Joaquin, and there has been an immense uproar. And listening to the council, the State Water Board members discuss it last week, they are quite split on what to do. And I think that if they try to implement their plan, it's going to be very, very politically difficult.
Mm.
And I don't know how they're going to resolve that. So, and these are government appointees that sit on the water board. So I think his biggest challenge right now, and I think we're all kind of looking at it, is, you know, how are we going to address what's going on at the State Water Board?
I think we should get one of them to come on our show. It's about. I mean, we've had people on from them before, but I think it's time to do a recap, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, kind of a significant thing. It you know, people don't want to say it. You know, it's not farms against fish, but it kind of, in a way, it is. But, you know, the farms and the economies have built up over the use of this water.
Right.
But it's impacting our ability to support species in our state that we want to support, like salmon. I mean, you can shrug your shoulder at the smell, but you know, people want salmon. We eat salmon. There are salmon fishermen out on the coast.
Yep.
You know, and the salmon are not surviving. So, you know, it is, I mean, you know, although no one wants to say it's farms versus fish, it, in a way it sort of is. It's back to, you know, how do we allocate the water between the farms, the cities, and the environment? And it's the thing we will struggle over, and we continue to struggle over.
Well, that's what I want to hear the candidates for governor. I want to hear their opinions and where they stand, and what they want to have for their legislation. I think that's important to me, because without water in California, I mean, things can go bad real quick.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yep. Absolutely. Well, so, the purpose of the show here, right? Bring attention to the water issues. I mean, there's a lot of stuff in California that needs attention. I mean, education, homelessness, infrastructure, roads, all that sort of stuff. But water is a big issue. It is one of the core elements and issues in California state politics.
I want to hear it's in the top three or top five from
sure.
either one of them. So we'll see.
Yeah.
Well, Chris, we're coming up against our break here. We do appreciate you being on our show every week. We love it. And anybody wants to follow Maven's Notebook, it's www.mavensnotebook.com. You can also subscribe to that and contribute to that if you'd like. It's a great, we use it all the time for making us smarter. At least I do. I don't know. Chris doesn't have to do that. But I do. But I mean, Chris here, not the Chris Maven.
But Chris Austin, but, yeah. Don't believe him. I read it every day.
He does. He honestly does.
I'm a big fan.
Yeah, I read it a couple.
All right.
I read it a couple times a week when I have a chance. But it's absolutely excellent. So and you get lots of kudos, as I told you last time on the show. Everybody comes up to me, talks about the show and how wonderful you are, and you're a great part of it, and that's why we keep getting all the good awards. We appreciate it. So
excellent.
So we'll talk to you next week. You have a good one, and stick around. We're going to be back with a great guest from all the way from Nevada, Las Vegas. That should be good. Yeah. So stick around for the second half of Water Zone. We'll be back in just a minute.
CAA Loma Linda, 1050 AM, K292 FQ Riverside, and K293 CF Moreno Valley.
If you knew there was a pipe cement that works better than the one you're currently using, is better for you and the environment, and costs the same or less, would you buy it? Well, no-brainer, right? Weldon, the trusted leader in solvent cements for over 60 years, is pleased to introduce a new line of solvent cements that does all that. Introducing the Eco Series line of solvent cements for PVC piping systems. Not only does it work great and set fast, it also has 30% lower solvent emissions and less smelly fumes, a better workplace environment when you're installing pipes. But don't just take our word for it. Eco Series products are the only solvent cements that are Green Seal certified for environmental innovation for effective performance, improved working conditions, and for use with potable water. Now available in a medium-bodied fast-setting blue formula, 905 Eco, and a regular-bodied fast-setting clear formula, 900 Eco. Pick up a can today from your local distributor and see, smell, and feel the difference, just like Joe Sweat, president of Sunrise Irrigation, did. He said, after using Weldon's 905 Eco, we immediately noticed the application was smooth and there was noticeably less odor than other blue solvent cements on the market. The guys love it. To learn more about Eco Solvent Cements from Weldon, visit the website at www.weldon.com or call the technical service hotline at 877-477-8327. That's 877-477-8327.
Let's talk drought stress. No one likes burnt plants or grass, especially your customers. So, when it's hotter than a tin roof in Tallahassee, what are you gonna do? Water the problem away? Not only does that abuse a vital resource, it's illegal in many cities. Here's a quick and easy solve that won't get you in trouble with Mother Nature or Johnny Law. Applied is a year-round program, Moisture Manager from LESCO supplements regular irrigation by attracting moisture to treated areas, thus making the moisture available to plant roots. This maintains wettability between waterings and rainfall, allowing soil to accept water as it becomes available, and making the water more accessible to the plant roots. Boom! More green, less watering, and a great new reason to see your customers on a recurring basis. With LESCO Moisture Manager and Site 1, high heat is no sweat.
And we have our great guest coming on. It's a gentleman I've known for quite a long time. He's not that old. I am, but he's not. And he's a great guy to work with. I worked with him for plus 12 years plus. Good guy. His name is Patrick Watson. He's the Conservation Service Administrator for Southern Nevada Water Authority. And he oversees all commercial, industrial, institutional, and multifamily conservation programs for Southern Nevada Water Authority. He also holds a bachelor's degree in engineering and is a certified water conservationist. So, Patrick, welcome to the show.
Hi, Rob. Nice to be on. Thanks for the invite.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's great to have you on the show. I know we're going to talk a little about what your organization does, and then I know there's an upcoming conference symposium that you guys do every year, and I want you to talk about that when we do. But kind of tell us what the state of water is in Nevada, both what it was and what it is today, and maybe what the future is going to hold.
Sure. So in Southern Nevada, we have 90% of our water comes from the Colorado River. And Nevada has the smallest allocation of any of the seven states that share the river. In fact, we're legally entitled to just 1.8% of the Colorado River. So while California gets 4.4 million acre-feet of water, Nevada only gets 300,000 acre-feet of water.
Did somebody lose something in a poker game or what?
Well, the river was divided up back in the 1920s, and if you think about Nevada, back then, we didn't have too many people living here, and we didn't have a lot of agriculture. So at that time, they thought that was a pretty good deal. And obviously, California, the Imperial Valley was growing, and certainly Los Angeles was growing. So so at that time, they felt that 300,000 acre feet was good enough. But as many of your listeners know, the Colorado River's currently in its 18th year of drought, and Lake Mead water levels are dropping, and they're down about 130 feet.
Wow.
And so last year, the flows of the Colorado River were only about 47% of average. And if we look at the past 18 years of drought, we only had 4 years of above average flow.
Wow.
So with declining water levels in Lake Mead, that's certainly a concern, and we continue to work with our partners on the river to reduce that water demand and keep Lake Mead elevation up.
I always joke about this company called the Water Train, and they gave me this little whistle. I love it. It's really cool. I didn't give it to my grandson because I thought this was really nice. I wanted to keep it for myself. But why can't there be alternative ways of getting water to there versus the typical flow?
You mean into the river or
into the dam?
Well, one of the things that we're doing with our river partners is we're looking at ways to, keep water in the dam. So mm-hmm. we work on, for us, we call it intentionally created surplus. So we have programs that we, and some are interstate programs. So, for example, the Yuma Desalter in Arizona, we helped with that, and certainly that helps keep water levels up. There's a program that we work with Metropolitan Water District and Arizona, and we put in money in a fund, and we help fund innovative conservation programs on the river. Mm-hmm. So, and any water that's saved through that remains in Lake Mead. So we're doing several things to keep the elevation of the lake up, and that's a collaboration with our lower basin partners and our upper basin partners. So that's certainly important.
Yeah. Hey, I'd like to welcome you to the show, Patrick. I'm Chris. I'm the co-host here with Rob.
Hi, Chris.
Rob spoke highly of you, but until I found out that you and Rob have known each other for 16 years, who are you hanging around with here? But no, Rob's a great guy. I like to tease him. I like to tease him a lot. So
I said he was certified.
yeah.
But hey, welcome, Patrick. Awesome to have you on the show. So my interest, part of the job that I do during the day, because Rob and I do have day jobs, is water conservation, of course, for the Toro Company. So, I've got a couple of questions I think that I'd like to ask in terms of the Southern Nevada Water Authority water conservation activities. What types are they? How are they accepted by your customers? So can you give us a little roundhouse view of what types of water conservation activities you guys offer?
Sure. You know, and first I think I need to kind of describe how we classify water here in Southern Nevada. So we classify it in two ways. So we have indoor water, which is about 40% of our total use is indoor water. And we classify that as non-consumptive use water. Outdoor water, which is about 60%, well, it is 60% of our use, is consumptive use. So, and when I say that, any water that hits a sanitary sewer or a drain, we capture it, clean it, we can put it back in Lake Mead and draw it right back out again, and we call it return flow credit. Outdoor water is lost to our system, so that's consumed. And that's, so our conservation programs are kind of geared towards the greatest opportunity, and that's outdoor water and cooling. So our programs kind of revolve around that. So, and what we've done in our community is, we have a great water ethic that's been created through our conservation programs. You know, obviously, Las Vegas is the driest city and the driest state in the Union. The Mojave Desert gets about 4 inches of rain a year. So one of the things that we use as initiatives is we have seasonal watering restrictions. So and it kind of follows the watering bell curve, you know, so in the winter and the beginning of the year, we, you know, will allow people to water one day a week, and then that goes up to three, and then it's 6 days a week through the summer, and then it goes back down to three, and then one. And that works out pretty well, and that saves about 15% of our seasonal water use.
That's significant.
Yeah. And then we do use development codes. We have development codes, so... as part of our program, you know, we have and I'll get into our Water Smart Landscapes program in a minute, but, you know, to take out turf, we are paying people to take out turf, but if we didn't develop codes that, we have development codes that don't allow turf in the front yard and 50% of the backyard can be turf or a swimming pool or something like that. So that helps us not chase our tail when we're paying people to take out turf. And that's worked out really well, and it really helps cement that ethic.
Have you had any issues like Metropolitan Water or LA Department of Water and Power when they were rationing is the wrong term, where they were identifying certain days of the week that some sections can water and then others, and they had a differential pressure problem and caused burst pipes? I hadn't heard that happen over in your area.
No, it hasn't. And you know, we have all of our... And what's nice is all of our member agencies, so all the surrounding cities that are our member agencies have worked on this. And so, you know, every property has an assigned watering day, and it works out with our member agencies and our distribution system. And then they have, you know, we have certain times that you can water. So, and it's worked out really well. And then we do have our incentive program. So, and people have really accepted those, and so right now I think we're doing a pretty good job. And you mentioned, you know, how has it been accepted? Well, you know, our population has gone up since 2002. It's gone up 43%, and our per capita water use is down 36%, and our consumptive use of Colorado River water is also down 26%. So the community has really embraced the conservation ethic.
And that's amazing, especially when you drive there and you see all these buildings with fountains and water fixtures and things like that, and people think, oh, look at all the water they're wasting, but they're really not wasting that water.
No, and you know, the resort, yeah, you know, people see that when they're driving down the Las Vegas Strip, but if you look at these resorts, if you take a closer look, less than 2% of their property is landscaping, so they want to give you the perception that it's lush and green and inviting, really, but they make their money with people in the building.
Yep.
And so if you really the resorts use more water cooling their building. But again, most of that water is non-consumptive water, because in a cooling tower situation, when water is blown down, it, we capture it and it gets back into our system.
Yep.
So these are really efficient buildings.
Oh yeah, I see a lot of hotels all across the country. Though they, you know, you go in and they have a little list, little piece of paper, tells you about, you know, if you're going to use the towels, you know, if you, you know, to, not to recycle them all the time, and they'll use them every 3 days. There was one innovative hotel that decided the best way to get people to stop the showers is don't provide the towels.
Yeah, just sit on the bed till you get dry.
Yeah. But what do you do for the commercial? I mean, because that's got to be a big portion of water consumption in general.
Yeah, and the commercial properties, we certainly have our Water Smart Landscapes program, which is available to homeowners as well. And we offer $3 per square foot for the first 10,000 square feet, and then $1.50 after that up to $300,000. So for commercial properties, that will... pretty much cover a small business, and that's why we put that 10,000 square foot cap there. But if you think about a commercial property, they, you know, this is turf that nobody is going to have a picnic on, and really the only person that's on it is the guy that's mowing it every week. So,
right.
And we look at that as non-functional. So our intent is not to have to strip every blade of grass out of Southern Nevada. We certainly don't want to do that. But we want to look at non-functional turf. So, you know, median islands, turf and median islands, that's something that's really not functional and can really be replaced with water-smart landscaping. So we look at that. But one of the best programs we have for commercial properties, and it's one of my favorites, is our water-efficient technology program. And we offer incentives for businesses to bring in water-efficient technology. So, for example, the program has two parts. It has a menu-based program and a performance-based side. And for the menu, these are technologies that we're familiar with. So, for example, high-efficiency shower heads and toilets and urinals. And we just recently added pulse tunnel washers for commercial laundries, which is... These are amazing machines that will wash a 150-pound pill, as they call it, in 90 seconds with less than a gallon of water.
Wow.
Yeah, and so the performance side it is the most flexible part of the program. So if there's a technology that a business wants to bring in that we're not familiar with, we'll study it for 6 months or longer, and then pay them an incentive on the water saving. So it really makes the program flexible, and we get to see new technologies come into Southern Nevada.
Oh, yeah. Well, a lot of the big commercial buildings, as you said earlier, they use a lot of water for the cooling. Their incentives for people to do things with that equipment?
Oh, certainly, yeah, and through the Water Efficient Technology Program. So, for example, we see cooling tower controllers. We have drift eliminators. We'll help pay for those controllers, water treatment systems that allow the cooling tower to use the water more times or more cycles. So yes, and that's what's really exciting. We kind of did an inventory of cooling on the Las Vegas Strip, and there are about 826,000 tons of cooling just on the Las Vegas Strip alone.
Almost a million tons.
You should have seen Chris and I's face when you said that.
Massive.
Yeah, there's some really big cooling towers on those buildings, and they're pretty impressive, and certainly they're very well taken care of. So anything that will that they can do to save water and energy with those systems, they'll try it. And you know, anything that they save goes right to the bottom line.
Mm-hmm. Hey, so Patrick, let me ask you another question, right? So great to have all these programs in place. Great to see that there is a lot of interest in them. So what does the Southern Nevada Water authority do to reach out? What kind of outreach, what kind of education, what sort of pull-through techniques or marketing do you use to gain and garner interest in the program?
Well, certainly we use, you know, we use the same company and to do our marketing that created the What Happens in Las Vegas Stays in Las Vegas. So they're very creative, and we have some great commercials and things like that. But in terms of education, you know, one of the barriers we discovered in our Water Smart Landscapes program for homeowners was they couldn't find a contractor to do the work. And so we created a Water Smart Contractor program. So we educate contractors on the proper installation of Water Smart Landscaping and drip irrigation. And we also give them a drought overview and kind of a water resource background so they can talk to customers, their customers, about water conservation. And this has been a great program for us because we have about 80 contractors on it right now. And we've had contractors call us and say, hey, can you take my name off your website because I just have too much work right now and I can't handle it all. So that works. And then we do homeowner drip irrigation classes at the Springs Preserve. And the Springs Preserve is a great facility here. It's a 180-acre site, and it's dedicated to sustainability, conservation, and desert living. And so we work with them very closely. They have a botanical garden. It's always good to homeowners can go out and look at plants that they, you know, might have interest in or get ideas. It's really a great facility and it's a great resource for the community as a whole. If you come to Las Vegas, I would put that on your list of things to do is visit the Springs Preserve.
Well, Chris is coming with me to the show, so he's
all right.
We can definitely take a look. But you know, that's an important thing what you just said on the vegetation. You know, I'll say I'm probably one of those people from years ago that couldn't believe that you can live in a home and have these water savings plants, because all I used to think it was things like succulent cactus and things of that, or ugly looking plants. And a friend of mine who worked for the city of Palm Desert, he's since retired, had given me a book on vegetation for those kind of areas, and it blew me away how beautiful the plants were. Just amazing to me. I never knew they existed, and I think a lot of people don't still even know that.
Right. Well, you've been to my house, yes. You know, I've taken out 5,000 plus square feet, 5,400 square feet of turf in the last several years, and replaced it with native plants: ceanothus, manzanita, salvia. And in the springtime and wintertime, my garden is just beautiful. It's a beautiful place.
Yeah, you know, and you get a lot of different textures and colors throughout the throughout the summer and throughout the year. So, yeah, it's just not a monochromatic green.
No, it isn't. Plus the birds, the wildlife, the butterflies, and the other animals that it attracts. I live very close to the mountains. There's only three streets above me before you're in the San Gabriels, and so. We attract a broad array of critters, too.
Oh, yeah.
Mammals, birds, and...
You're not talking about me when they came for dinner,
nope,
right?
Nope, I wasn't.
Okay.
I'll tell
my wife you didn't mean it. That's all right.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, it's just to illustrate that there is a lot of value in converting to water-wise landscapes, right? Not just think of it as you're giving up something, right? I'm giving up my lawn, and it's not really true, right? Most of the time, that lawn that I was using, as you say, Patrick, the only person that walked on it was the gardener once a week when he pushing the lawnmower across it. So,
yeah, you know,
what did you lose?
In my neighborhood, I put in Water Smart Landscaping, and my neighbor across the street, great guy, and he had the most manicured lawn you could ever imagine. It was beautiful, and he took really good care of it. But I would go out and maybe pick up something that blew into my yard and pick it up, and I would be done. And he would be 2-3 hours on a Saturday morning, you know, working out in his yard. And so
yeah, the maintenance is a big
yeah, cut down on maintenance. And we, you know, I'd just kind of let it be as natural as I could. And and you know, just the colors were stunning. So,
well, you're young enough to get up bright and early on Saturdays and Sundays like Chris and go out there and all do all that. I got to the point in my life where I do HID. Hire it done.
Hire it done.
The last thing I want to do is come home and work on my irrigation system.
Well, Patrick, some great stories about successes from conservation programs that we've had on the program in the past have always entertained our listeners. So, can you give us a little, just some insight into what are some of the success stories that Southern Nevada Water has
sure.
seen from your programs?
Yeah, we're very proud of the accomplishments we have, and since 1999, we've replaced 185 million square feet of lawn with water smart landscaping, and we've saved 119 billion gallons of water. And we did that, we've done that while our population grew by 650,000 new residents. And so we really feel like we've, made some great strides in creating that conservation ethic. And I think that's the important thing is, as a community, we do have that ethic, and everybody thinks about conservation. And moving forward, we have confidence that we'll continue that.
Well, that kind of leads on to the last topic here, and I want you to promote a little bit about the upcoming Smart Innovations Conference that started a few years ago. And I was with Doug Bennett, who's one of your guys, and we were discussing that before it was, well, it was in his head before it was even happened. Can you tell us a little about it, our listeners about it, and anybody who wants to come and where they can find out about it and everything?
Oh, sure. So every October, the first week in October, we host the world's largest urban water efficiency conference. So we have public and private industry folks that come in, and it's always in the same place. It's at the South Point Hotel and Casino, and it's... what I like about it is the collaboration and the networking. So we have 108 professional sessions every year, and this is our 11th year.
Yep.
And Rob, I think you've been to all of them.
Every single one from day one.
That's right. And what's nice is what I like about it is the networking between sessions. So the sessions create conversations that happen in the hallway, and the sharing of ideas. So one of the things we discovered was that, as Southern Nevada, we might have ideas about conservation and how water's used here, and then there might be a smaller city that has similar issues, but on a smaller scale, and how can they deal with them, or how do they deal with them? And we get to share those ideas. And so we think everybody benefits. And every year, we usually have about 43 different states represented and 7 different countries. So it has an international flavor to it, and there's a lot of ideas and collaboration going on that is really exciting.
Yeah, it's great to hear that, you meet all these people from all over and all their little issues that are happening, and there's lots of people who can, it's a great networking place because you learn a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
That's awesome. How do people find out about Smart Innovations?
Well, they can go to watersmartinnovations.com, and that's our website, and they can find out about registration and room rates and different things. The South Point is a great facility. Room rates are really reasonable, and it's October 3rd through the 5th this year.
Yep.
And don't forget to check out the tours.
Right, absolutely. And we're going to be broadcasting there as well.
Yeah, that's great.
So that'll be fun for us. We do that every single year. We'll interview a lot of the people who are attending and a lot of the exhibitors, and we're looking forward to doing that. And hopefully you'll stop by. Maybe you can bring Doug with you.
Oh, absolutely.
I always like to say hi to him. And I got to say, you guys have been nothing but first class in all the things that you guys put together. And it's been a pleasure working with you guys forever and ever. So we appreciate that.
Well, thank you. And we appreciate you guys working with us.
Great. All right. Well, thanks, Patrick. We're up against our NBC News Hour that we have to go because they're bigger than we are. we don't have a choice. So anyway, thanks a lot, and we appreciate it. And to our listeners, you all have a great week. And remember, the most important thing to do is
think blue
and get on that train.
See you next week, everybody.
We're crazy, I think.
CAA Loma Linda, 1050 AM, 106.5 FM, and now 102.3 FM.